All right. Hello, everyone. Can you hear me? Is this good? Hi. Welcome to the Boston Book Festival. This session is called Being Creative. My name is Zininjor Enwemeka. I'm a reporter at WBUR. I cover a lot of things at WBUR. You'll see my work online at WBUR.org and on air on 90.9 FM. One of the things I cover is also innovation, which is something that we'll be talking a bit about. And so we have two great authors with us this morning to talk about what it means to be creative, what it means to be inventive, and so we're going to have a great discussion. So I'll introduce our two authors here. So first we have Pagan Kennedy here to my left. And Pagan Kennedy, she is a writer, a journalist, and creator of the popular New York Times Magazine column, Who Made That? She is a former MIT Science Journalism Fellow and recipient of the Massachusetts Book Prize for Nonfiction. She's also written 11 books, including this one, which is called Inventology. And the book offers what you can really describe as a delightful account of how inventors do what they do. And so this book draws from research and stories behind many of the inventions that we use in our everyday lives, both old and new. So welcome, Pagan.
Thank you.
All right. And our next author here is Alexa Clay. Over here, and she is a writer, strategist, and expert on social innovation. She's a co-founder of the League of Intrapreneurs, which is a movement to create change within big business. And she's also the co-founder and director of the Human Agency. It's a global nonprofit that encourages the development of breakthrough ideas. She's also co-written this book that I have here. It's called The Misfit Economy. And The Misfit Economy is about things that we can learn from, things that we can learn about creativity from some sort of unusual sources. So pirates, hackers, gangsters, and other outcasts and outsiders. So Alexa's gonna talk to us a bit about some of the things that we can learn from, you know, people who aren't sort of your Steve Jobs types when it comes to creativity and innovation. All right, so to kick things off, I would like each of our authors are going to just speak for a few minutes a bit about their books, their work, and give us a little bit of an insight into what it means to be creative, what it means to be inventive. So to start off, we'll start with Pagan, who has a short presentation.
Yeah, thanks so much, and thanks to you guys for coming out today. And this is on the screen. So yeah, I actually have to give myself a demotion from your wonderful introduction. I didn't actually create the Who Made That column in the New York Times Magazine. I was hired in to do it for almost 2 years. But they would give me an object, and then I would have to say how it came into being every week. So super quickly, here are some of the columns I did. Sometimes that was an object that I picked that object, but usually I didn't get to pick. Anyway, so after doing this a lot and talking to zillions of people who had come up with ideas, especially kind of those hidden in plain sight ideas that you can't believe you didn't think of first, you know, I began to notice several patterns in the way that these ideas develop. And that's when I kind of knew I had a book on my hands. And so I'm going to, as quickly as I can, go through one of the first pattern that I noticed. And that is that it really takes a lot of creativity to find the right problem, to see the problem that millions of people are suffering from, but they don't even notice is there. So I'm going to tell you one super quick story about one of these problems and what it takes to see the problem in the most kind of granular way that really leads you to solve it. So this is an airport in the 1960s. You'll notice everybody's wearing a lot of plaid. But what do you guys notice about the luggage?
No wheels,
right? Like, all these people did not see this like major opportunity to do less work, right? And one reason is that people didn't fly a lot. They didn't think about having special luggage for the airport. That seemed crazy at the time. But in the early 70s, there was a luggage executive who had this great idea to put wheels on luggage because he realized that people were flying a lot now, or going to be flying a lot more. So this was a product that did very well in the early 70s. Can you guys see any problems with it? Still have to pick it up. What else? Like, it flops, right? And then you're dragging this thing along. What about when you go downhill? It's going to start attacking you, right? Okay, so if you're flying, you know, once in a while, this thing is totally fine. It makes your life better. But what if you're a stewardess or a pilot or somebody in the air crew who is in the airport every day toting your luggage and maybe your flight logs with you, right? You're going to start to see those problems. And not only that, you're going to suffer from them all the time, and you're going to wake up at 3 in the morning thinking about them, right? Because your ankles are now covered with cuts and bruises, and you're literally feeling the pain of it, okay? So we say necessity is the mother of invention, but it's long-term, ongoing necessity that really mothers invention. So this was the design that a pilot named Robert Plath came up with in the 80s. And he was thinking of only first making this for himself. It was also designed, you can see it solved all the problems of the previous model, and it's designed to go into the overhead, which is, you know, if you're a road warrior, you definitely need that. And he was originally just sold it to other people who were in flight crews, because the idea was, well, normal people wouldn't need this. But then flying truly began to suck, and all of us reached the point where we would like buy anything, take any drug to lessen the pain of it, and that's when this really took off. So he also lucked out that the future went in the right way, that the problem evolved. It could have evolved a different way where flying didn't suck so much and you wouldn't need this thing. Eric von Hippel, who's an economist who is not far from here, when I interviewed him, he said that the ones that aren't even a product we would think of yet, come from the users who are on the leading edge. So surgeons design surgical equipment. Surfers figure out you can skateboard. You know, so there's just these populations of people who see the problem and the answer in a new way because they're at the forefront of the problem and feeling the pain of it. But we don't always empower those people. And you're looking at me, so I'm just going to say one more slide. And this is one thing I've become very passionate about post-book and writing about now, is the fact that the people in the room are not diverse enough and they don't suffer from a diverse enough set of problems. Our engineers, the people who are empowered to solve problems, should be far more diverse. So here's an illustration of that. How many, so I did my own little survey of of the modern tampon patent space. How many people think 75% of tampon-related patents came from women? Okay, how about 50%? How about 25%? All right, you're right. Okay, that's a problem. I'm going to end there. We can discuss. Thanks.
We'll have to pick that point back up. All right, so Alexa, can you talk to us just a little bit about some of your work, what you have found about sort of off the beaten path creative characters.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a great bridge, really, because so much of what I explored in The Misfit Economy was speaking to people who don't fit that Steve Jobs profile, who don't fit that kind of Silicon Valley hoodie-wearing tech bro persona, was really to say, who are the innovators, who are the creatives, who are the entrepreneurs, who, you know, maybe had spent time in jail and so ended up speaking to hackers, to gangsters, to pirates, to artists, to a lot of people that are applying an entrepreneurial mindset but are operating in very different kinds of contexts. And so some of my first conversations were actually, you know, in a room not unlike this one. And I remember meeting four guys who had recently gotten out of prison. And at one point in the conversation, one just, you know, paused and pointed around the room at all these different objects that could be turned into weapons. And so that totally arrested me, and I felt a little bit afraid. But then I also felt amazed and blown away by just that frugality at work, that creative problem solving. And so really started having more conversations, got involved with an organization called Defy Ventures, which was set up by a woman who used to work in venture capital and private equity. And she ended up doing volunteer work at prisons on the weekends. And in prison, she noticed that there were tons of entrepreneurs in our prison systems, that they'd run successful drug businesses. And if you've run a successful drug business, then you know how to do to manage product quality, to build out a customer base, to do recruitment and retention of employees. You're maybe less good at risk management because you're in prison, but you have all these skills that you can apply that are incredibly entrepreneurial. And I think so part of the challenge then becomes how do you work with these guys once they're out of prison, who really have very restricted opportunity to jobs, to actually see some of their assets, for them to be able to re-narrate their resumes and re-narrate their CVs to kind of transform the hustle. And so that was the purpose of the program that she set up. She really worked with ex-cons, initially running business plan competitions in prisons, and then moving on to set up an incubator where she really leveraged all the social capital that she had built up within the venture capital world and said, how can we apply this to create opportunities for ex-cons to start their own businesses? And so it was really through conversations like this where I just really became interested in how do we create more bridges, more pathways for misfit subcultures to infect the mainstream. Not only how do we give people more access to economic opportunity, but what are the different practices within some of these subcultures that we can apply to mainstream thinking and to mainstream business? And so the book really goes through a number of these different principles. I think the common trait that we so often see within traditional entrepreneurship and more informal entrepreneurship, which is huge. Around the world, the informal sector can be sometimes 70% of a country's GDP. Taken together, this is over $10 trillion. And so the sheer size of these markets mean that we can't really ignore them. It's kind of a blind spot within the story of capitalism that we tell ourselves. And in fact, the US's own industrial, you know, miracle, the Industrial Revolution, owed to a lot of these kinds of actors. So it was really early patent robbers who stole patents from European countries and commercialized these entirely illegally in the US that allowed for this industrial development process to take fold. And now we see similar kinds of things happening in China, in India. I was just in South Korea yesterday, so I'm feeling the jet lag, but you know, in these Shanghai kind of copycat markets. And so that was another principle that we looked at is, you know, how much this myth of intellectual property really needs to change. We're seeing the rise of open source culture, which is a great challenge to that. But in many ways, in these countries, this is a pathway to development, and you know, we shouldn't rob countries of that. One of the first patent robbers that I interviewed was essentially a modern-day Robin Hood in India. He was reverse engineering pharmaceutical drugs and manufacturing them much more affordably and accessibly for the poor. And so, because of rogue actors like him, as well as the generics manufacturers, pharmaceutical companies ended up having to change their pricing models wheels to compete. Initially, they went after them with lawyers, and after that didn't work, they had to really develop more innovative kinds of practices. So rather than demonize some of these actors, I think it's really important to recognize that they're putting a lot of pressures on our mainstream institutions to evolve. And there's really no story of capitalism without a story of the shadow economy. And so one other subculture that I wanted to mention, just because I was talking to Ben earlier, is the wonderful field of live action role playing. And so this gets us out of the illegality. I don't know, maybe you guys have conjured up a little bit of illegality, but if you want to know more about live action role playing, definitely talk to Ben. But how many people have participated in a LARP in their life? Okay, that's great. That's way more than most audiences that I've asked that question to. And so I started exploring LARP around a year ago, and I think it's really fascinating as a creative practice for two reasons. The first is around this identity hacking piece. I think, we were just kind of lamenting the sort of work as a public speaker at times. And the moment I had to buy alexaclay.com, I felt like a total asshole. And, you know, we're facing all these pressures to commodify our identity on LinkedIn and Facebook and personal website and personal branding. And so what I love about live action role playing is this opportunity to really hack yourself, to take on a new identity, to explore this whole range that you have within yourself. So in a LARP, you'll often get this character sheet. I was interviewing someone who was a deeply introverted person, really shy guy, and through LARPs, he actually taught himself really valuable skills around how to be more extroverted, how to be more of a charismatic leader. And the other reason that I think LARPing is fascinating is it gives us this opportunity to prototype and test out alternative worlds. And so a lot of the people that I profile in the book, they're not just interesting because they're kind of these lone ranger misfit types that are being, you know, inventive. They're interesting because they're part of communities that are creating alternative kinds of cultures. And I think this is what you find that LARP is an amazing petri dish for, is the ability to pop up different realities, different scenarios around dystopia, utopia. If you want to understand the future of our financial systems, rather than run kind of scenario analysis or interview a bunch of experts, you can actually begin to embody some of these futures and see what they might feel like a little bit more. So I think it's something that hopefully we'll see a rise in and make sexy. That was our mission here today. And you've also LARPed, right? Okay, so maybe we can talk about that a little bit later. And then the last thing that I wanted to mention that inspired partially by LARP, but then also really by visiting with different Amish communities across the U.S. I think, you know, we think of innovation today and we just associate that with tech innovation. And so I wanted to explore Amish communities because I think they offer us a really different way of thinking about innovation. It's not that they believe in technology abstinence, but they have much more of a slow adoption. You know, you'll have beta testers within Amish communities that will actually be able to test out a product to see whether or not they want to roll it out. And they're asking important questions around what are the filters that we put on technologies before we integrate them. If you read an Amish newspaper, they have their own sort of plain papers. You'll see advertisements, for example, for cell phones. But the way that the phones are advertised is, not having distracting apps, not being able to access the internet. They're really done around these plain kinds of features. And so spending more and more time with folks like this and learning about emerging Amish businesses like Camel Milk, I got really interested in how do we bring more of that intentional approach to community development into the sort of mainstream milieu, which is so often hijacked by this need to be disruptive and this need to be a first adopter of technology. And so I started doing a performance character where I would dress up as an Amish woman. I bought a bonnet and a prairie dress, actually from an Amish e-retailer, which is interesting. And I started wandering around tech conferences like South by Southwest and London Social Media Week. And it was great because if you're an Amish woman at a tech conference, everyone wants to talk to you. But, you know, I have a love of philosophy, too. So what I did was, in creating this alter ego, her name was Rebecca, I was able to really ask more Socratic questions. I was able to sort of convert my own critical, judgmental thinking around, well, what are these startups actually doing in the world? How can they actually amplify what it means to be human? How do we use the tech for good? And so it was a way of having those conversations through this performance character, but in a way that felt soft, felt delicate, created interaction, allowed people to come into this confessional space where they felt safe to actually admit that they have technological phobias or that they don't actually believe existentially in what they're building. And so it was a way at poking and prodding at some of that malaise. I think I'm at time.
Yeah,
great. Okay,
no, thank you so much, Alexa. That was great. So just real quick, you mentioned the term LARP. Can you just explain what that stands for, just for folks who might
know? So you might understand LARP from movies, where it's live-action role-playing. It's often associated with an image of, like, nerds running around in the woods with swords. Not true. Sometimes it is this, actually. But it can also be a much more kind of elaborate, playful art where you can jump into different scenarios over the course of a few hours or a weekend, or you can have an extended LARP. I played a LARP where we were basically summiters. So we, in someone's living room with tents set up, we were basically summiting this mountain, and I had to play a tech billionaire who had funded the expedition but was basically a sort of narcissist and really annoying to everyone else there. So that was interesting to feel kind of that alienation and hatred. But it's a very interesting tool just from an emotional development perspective, you know, in terms of being able to bring forward different elements that we have inside of us.
All right. Thank you so much, Alexa. That was great. So, Pagan, I want to bring you back into the conversation. I just have some questions for you guys. You raised a few really great points. And so, Pagan, you were talking a bit about some interesting stories of innovation and invention. Do you have a favorite story that you researched that you came about, and can you share it?
Wow, there's so many. One story, I think there was another pattern I noticed, which I've been actually kind of really digging into post book, which is that, you know, we often think of invention or creativity as happening forwards, where you see the problem and then you find the solution. But there's all these people who find the solution first, and then they tend to, like, say, this is really cool. You know, it feels like they found a $20 bill on the ground or something. It's like, this is so cool, I don't know what it's good for. And then they kind of go looking for the problem. And there's spheres in which every single big breakthrough came from that accidental invention or serendipitous method. So
can you give an example?
Yes. Yeah, so artificial sweeteners, whatever you feel about them, every single one I could find did not come from somebody looking for an artificial sweetener. It came from, there were three cases of sweeteners where somebody was trying to make something else, like an ulcer drug, and then later in the day, they put their, you know, they were eating a sandwich, and they were like, this tastes really sweet, you know, and then they realized, they traced it back to this chemical. And then there was, my favorite story in the sweetener realm is, there was this chemist who was working with a student, and he said to the student, I want you to test this compound. And the student thought he said, I want you to taste this. And so he actually drank it down.
So dangerous.
But he didn't die, and it became sucralose. I think that was the one. So, you know, I mean, in the artificial sweetener space, all the pieces of the compounds don't taste sweet. But it's when you put them together that, and in a way that's very hard to predict, that they taste sweet. So the question is, how do you get into the unknown unknown? How do you explore the things you don't even know you don't know about? That happens by us bumping in, bumping around willy-nilly, and also using this kind of creative observation method. And that turned out to be much more important. It was something that was not really on my radar when I started writing the column, but But actually made a lot of sense to me, because in journalism, as you guys know, we have this term gathering string, where you would say, I'm working on this story, I don't even know if there's a story here, but I'm gathering string. And that means you're just talking to people, bumping around, hanging out somewhere, trying to see what. And the string could be anywhere, you know, it could be the plane flying overhead, it could be the way the floor, you know, the flooring is. You're just waiting for the things that pop out and begin to look like dots that you can connect. And that requires, so I think we often don't think of creativity as like baked into observation. But, you know, if you think of tinkering, the word tinkering and how often it's associated with invention, that sort of aimless playing with things and trying, you know, often trash, turning something into, or turning nothing into something, is very much part of that tinkering process. So that really emerged in many, many of the stories that I heard, yeah.
And did you see any sort of consistent characteristics or traits among some of these people who came up with these inventions? Was there a common trait or common sort of approach to how they came up with these ideas?
Well, you know, actually, because invention is kind of a bunch of different things, like it's really different to invent a drug than it is to invent a piece of sporting equipment. So there were actually sort of, I would say, a whole set of different personalities. But to speak to Alexa's point, you know, the other thing that really emerged was, as I was, week after week, interview talking to all these inventors, I mean, the big theme was they were very unhappy in the corporate sphere, which was completely stultifying. And in fact, often they were prevented, more often than not, the management prevented their idea. Now, there's a reason for this that you can point to, which is like, say you're, you know, working in a drug company and you happen to find something that you think could cure baldness. Now, that discovery has zero value where you are. And it's very hard to move. Often the inventors themselves have to carry that idea into another sphere and take all the risk of that. We can talk about this too. There's new marketplaces where online where people can win money for having ideas like this. And it's facilitating these exchanges, taking the ideas from where they have no value to where they do have value. But it's still really hard. And to give you an example of that, the inventor of the UPC code, that barcode that's on everything now, and I'm forgetting his name, but I talked to him, and he was at, I think it was IBM in the 70s when they were working on this, and his boss, everybody was like fixated on the idea that this had to be a target shape, because it always had been. And he realized, like, if it's low quality and you're scanning it and it's a target, it's going to smear and the ink's going to smear and it's not going to work. And he's like, it's got to be lines, because for all these reasons. And he had to like go up against management and fight and fight and fight and for that idea. And his bosses hated it, and he made no money from it. And in the end, all he does, he gets like paranoid conspiracy theorists hunted him down for the rest of his life, because they all think that the 666 code.
Oh gosh.
And so he's like, I didn't get anything except for like a lot, you know, zero money. He said, I got none of the meat and all of the nuts. And that's often the inventor's story. They stick up for an idea. They don't get rewarded for it. And they may get fired for it. So that's something, it seems like, really went along with what you're seeing.
Yeah, 100%. I mean, I think, and I've spent kind of 7 years before the misfit economy working with exactly that profile of person, the kind of frustrated misfit in the corporate trenches who is trying to navigate that system and is just facing so much resistance and pushback. And I think part of Yeah, part of what I was really trying to understand with the misfit economy too was, what are different ways of escaping our command and control systems? Because they're not working for people. They're extremely, not only are they not allowing for creativity and innovation, but they're often extremely dehumanizing experiences where people are really checking themselves out when they go to work, where they're not allowed to be at work kind of with their full authenticity. And so part of what the League of Entrepreneurs was about was to say, you know, how do you bring that full self into the workplace? And so we started really a guerrilla movement for people that wanted to bring this more revolutionary approach, not only to companies, but also to any kind of bureaucratic system or structure. And it felt a little bit at the beginnings like we were creating something modeled loosely on like Alcoholics Anonymous, where people could come together and share their kind of misunderstood identity and find that sense of entourage and support, and then really workshop people around key skills. So really, upskilling people around the art of making a successful business case, because innovation is one component, but then how do you sell that in to organizations? And I think part of the trap for people that might identify as a little bit of a misfit is to sort of hunker down in that lonely, misunderstood outsider. And how do you actually, create a bridge between what you're excited about and other people's realities? And so people that are really good at that are con artists, for example. If you look at the salesmanship of con artists, they're amazing at being able to paint pictures that get people really excited. There was a famous con artist called Gregor McGregor, who was a Scotsman, and he created a fictitious colony that he attracted over 200 settlers to back in the day, and also raised a ton of money around. And the reason he was successful is he made it really three-dimensional for people. He created a fake natural history of this colony. He created a fake currency. He created fake ballads. He gave himself like a fake title. And so he had all these artifacts that enrolled people in this reality. And I think so often when we pitch ideas, we're dependent on the PowerPoint slides or just, you know, a meeting, none of these being conducive necessarily to that visioning piece. So I think there are all these dynamics at play. And what's exciting too is to see this trend where a lot of our systems and organizations are trying to evolve to operate much more egalitarianly, to operate with much more horizontal principles and distributed leadership. And so where I see a lot of creativity coming in, mostly comes from this world bridging. A lot of the misfits that I spoke to, the reason that they had creative ideas to begin with is they had kind of insider-outsider approaches. They had one foot in one reality and one foot in another, and they were trying to bring those realities closer together. So one example is this great collective called Inspiral in New Zealand. And so they had a really mixed DNA between being full of activists, basically, being part of the Occupy movement and really founding this organization around that time, and then also being programmers and being freelancers. And so they brought these pieces together and they started creating software tools like Lumio, where they could allow groups to make decentralized decisions. And so I think more and more that kind of ability, where we're not just living in these kind of worlds without oxygen, but we're able to graft some of these different kinds of subcultures into the mainstream, allows for much more creative thinking and new approaches, and also more human cultures.
So I want to ask you both, I mean, how do you think individuals can bring that type of energy into whatever their particular work situation is, whether it's corporate or some other type of business? How can people bring that that innovation, that creative spirit into their workplace and deal with some of the challenges of management that they may face?
Well, I think one of the things I noticed from interviewing different generations of inventors up to today is we are so lucky to be living in this time because we have so many ways to get out of that trap. Now, in your pocket with your phone, you have more tools than the top engineers would have had at Bell Labs in the 1960s. You can fund a project, you can buy like anything you need off of Alibaba, any part you need for really very cheap. You can 3D print prototypes, which, you know, or a thing in the shape, which believe it or not, that was like the hardest, that was such a hard nut to crack. But, you know, the inventors I talked to from even the early 2000s, they often, to go forward, they might have to mortgage, you know, put their house, a second mortgage on their house. They would have to risk everything they had. The guy who did the sippy cup, you know, he knew he had a really big idea. He couldn't go forward with it on his own. You were at the mercy of a company to license it. Now, you know, because of Kickstarter and all of this, or even just going straight to Amazon, you can do things directly. So I would say that, you know, there's just these tremendous spaces online for us. And I would like to urge you guys to check out one of those spaces that you probably haven't heard of. And it's this site called Innocentive. INNOCENTIVE.com, I think. And there's different spaces like this, but this is the biggest one. And it's a marketplace for inventive ideas. So people, not NASA or a nonprofit or a company, will post a problem they can't solve with a prize money on it. And anybody, you, can participate. You can, you know, compete if you want. And that is, you know, as Alex is talking about, creating these, like, more of these ways where people can get into the right place. That is really interesting. I interviewed one of the winners, who was this guy, Adam Rivers, who is a marine biologist. And he, so it's really fun to look through the problems because they're awesome. I mean, you find out, so it just gets your imagination really going. It's like, could you make a clothes washing machine with no water? Mm-hmm. How to make a better fish ladder, you know, so fish can get around dams. How do we keep tag surgical equipment so it doesn't get lost in people's bodies in a better way? You know, things like that, these really nitty gritty problems. And there's a local, Kareem Lakhani, I don't know if I'm saying his name right, but he's a local scholar who's looked at this and found that the outsiders in a field are much more likely to solve the problem than the insiders. So Adam Rivers saw this. He's a marine biologist. He sees this problem about a food company is trying to do a health shake, and it's turning this like really disgusting color of purple. Now, because he deals with bacteria in the ocean, he knows that there's reactions around iron, which can turn the water a really weird color. And he basically, in one weekend, figured out, oh, it's got to be the iron in the drink, and it's reacting with something else. And he solved that and won $25,000 by doing, like, some experiments in his kitchen. But, you know, it's like the problem that's impossible for the food scientists to solve, for the marine biologists, it's like, oh, this is so obvious. So it's about moving people into the sphere and find, you know, pairing the right people with the right problem. And I think that's something you're really looking at too.
Yeah, I think just that outsider approach is, I mean, with Kat's starting DeFi, you know, taking the sort of venture capital tools, and she wasn't working in prison reform or rehabilitation, and she was able to crack that problem with a totally new lens on it. There was another person we interviewed in the book, Gary Sletkin, and he worked in infectious disease for 15 years in refugee camps, often looking to contain tuberculosis and malaria and HIV and AIDS. And he burnt out and went back to Chicago and started just studying violence and patterns of how violence happens in local neighborhoods. And he saw that violence spreads exactly like an infectious disease. And so that allowed him to reframe violence as something that is doesn't make someone a bad person, but it's actually a contagious process. And so then he set up an organization that was all around taking the models that he'd pioneered in healthcare and saying, how do we actually develop a community outreach approach to violence prevention? And so his whole organization really worked on that model. So I think it's this kind of code switching, this ability to take really different sorts of perspectives and bring it into problem solving, which is the necessity of diversity, which I think you touched on.
Yeah, I was just going to bring back that point. You mentioned this idea of having this different perspective and bringing it into a totally different space. And so you mentioned diversity earlier and the importance of that. Can you speak a little bit more about that and how diversity can lead to more creativity and more innovation?
Sure. So actually, I just signed a contract to be a contributing writer at the New York Times opinion page, and I just did a story for them. So there's this problem that has stumped engineers for a really long time, okay? So it would be great if we could do medical tests at home, right? But most of them require a whole vial of blood, and nobody is going to draw, no consumer is going to draw a vial of blood out of their arm at home, okay? A lot of people, like decades of people, have been trying to crack that, because if you could solve that problem, a lot of new things could be possible. So there was this woman, Reedy Tarial, who was actually at the Harvard Business School. She's also an engineer. And she was thinking about, well, how could we give women a home fertility test? And so she was circling around this problem, because the tests would also require a lot of blood. So she's going, women and blood. Women and blood, women and blood.
And we're back.
Wow, there's a really obvious low-hanging fruit solution here. So she began looking into menstrual blood and saying, could we actually use that as a new way to get information out of people's bodies? Turns out, as she began doing this research, menstrual blood contains not just blood, but it contains all these cells shed by the body, including ovarian cells. So what you're getting is this whole portrait of what's going on in the reproductive system without doing any surgery. And so that led her, now she and her partner are already in clinical studies looking at if they've developed this gizmo that can collect the menstrual blood and turn it into a medical sample, and they're looking at if they can do early detection of endometriosis now, and they're hoping to target cancer and STDs next. And so that's a situation where, you know, having male engineers in the space prevents you from seeing the super obvious solution, and just getting the right people in the room suddenly opens up all kinds of new things, new opportunities that we're not looking at. Yeah.
And so
you probably have a story like that too. I don't know.
A menstrual blood story.
Well, I mean,
getting
the right, the problem that seems impossible until you kind of find the
person.
Until
you get the right people in the room. You get different voices in the room.
I guess one thing that I'm exploring more and trying to do more in the work that I'm doing is around this question of how do we bring very different kinds of people to work around common challenges. So when we launched the Misfit Economy, for example, in New York, we brought all these, former, basically sort of criminal all-stars together. So we had George Young, who Johnny Depp played in the movie Blow. We had King Tone, who used to run the Latin Kings and was essentially trying to do change management of an underground organization, saying, how do we pivot this street organization to become more of a civic movement like the Black Panthers? So I think that also is interesting around this idea of like legacy innovation. How can we think about sort of repurposing existing infrastructures? But the real purpose here was to say, how can we get these guys connected to emerging entrepreneurial talent, and what business insights can they actually, can they offer? And it was just incredibly energetic for everyone to be there, because these were pockets of society that don't often overlap. And I think the more that we can get outside of our echo chambers a little bit, and I think we're seeing this now with the election here, it's like so many of us are so baffled because we don't have insight to talk to some of those types of people on a regular basis. A friend of mine created this great app the last election cycle that was basically shout roulette. So it was at a time when chat roulette was popular, but it would connect you, for example, with like a Trump supporter, and you could just yell at them for like 30 minutes.
That.
So I guess it might sound more basic, but I just think, how are we creating conversational containers that can really be designed around inclusion and bring very different voices to the table? And I'm excited about that, I guess, too, because it's about social fabric. It's about, you know, really how do we weave together social fabric? And ultimately, that's where innovation ecosystems come from. You know, if we look at the success of things like Silicon Valley, it's because there are dense networks of people that are supporting each other. And so how do we do that as a society where it's not just kind of a white entitled boys club, but it feels like we're all being able to have these conversations and build relationships that advance our agency in the world?
So, Alexa, you talked earlier a bit about, you know, folks who work in gray spaces and maybe sort of in an illegal way. And so I'm curious about, I mean, that seems like it would be such a challenge. And I'm curious about what are some of the issues, if there is sort of great lessons that we can learn from folks who are working in those spaces, how can that be, I know you said you're working on, you know, how to bring those folks into, I guess, the mainstream, or to bring those two sides together. But you mentioned the person in India who is creating cheaper drugs. And so my first thought is, well, are they safe? Are they regulated? Yeah. Because obviously, as a society, we have layers of regulation and sort of checks in place to make sure things are safe or are appropriate to be on the market. And so I'm curious how folks who work off, like in the black market, are, you know, subscribing to that, or how that can be managed?
Yeah, I think it's an important question, and I don't think the point of the book is to sort of like glorify criminality or for everyone to feel like they should be a criminal. far from it. But yeah, I mean, one good example is things that are happening on the dark web. So, for example, a lot of drug marketplaces are moving online, and you can buy, you know, drugs on these marketplaces where you use Bitcoin. And what's great about those is they're actually ensuring better product quality in so many ways. So in the same way that you can write a review on Amazon around a product, this is actually ensuring that people can know what they're buying. I think more and more you're seeing a wave of sort of decriminalization where a lot of gray market practices or products are becoming more formalized. So I've hung out with like Appalachian moonshiners who got really excited in 2009 because moonshine became legalized there. And so it was a way that the state had to actually access more revenue during a recession. And so you had all these old-timey moonshiners that are now working with people with entrepreneurial acumen to develop these new moonshine that actually have better quality, and they prefer working there because now they can actually ensure that quality, and they can get investors on board to actually invest in, you know, distillers and things that will make that quality better. I think you're seeing the same things too with cannabis in Colorado and Seattle and places where the product's quality is going up because of it's been legalized. Camel milk is another one that the Amish have actually been doing somewhat underground for a while. And I think people, you know, the FDA has similar qualms about, you know, unpasteurized milk. But their innovation was to sell it through buyers clubs. So similar to how HIV and AIDS and drug medications were sold in the 80s, if you saw Texas, what was it, Dallas Buyers Club?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, Dallas Buyers Club. And so I think that practice is now being used by people that are saying, well, how do we aggregate demand, similar to how Kickstarter is a way of actually aggregating demand of potential customers. So the Amish are doing that through these buyers clubs. And I think more and more that creates opportunities for distributed production, where this whole narrative around kind of maker culture and citizen production is becoming more possible.
And you said that the Amish are doing that with camel milk?
With camel milk, yeah, okay. Which is tasty.
So they
We've
have
never tried
camels?
It. There are tons of Amish people with camels, yeah.
Okay. It's creating a weird image
in
my head.
It's the revenue model is mixed because part of it is about the camel milk, and then part of it is about renting the camels for, like, nativity scenes. So there was this problem of, like, what do you do when it's not Christmas? And that's how...
Camel milk.
Camel milk came, yeah.
Okay, so we have about 10 minutes left in this session, and so I want to also open it up to the audience if you guys have questions for our two writers here.
This is sort of a comment, a question disguised as a comment. One thing, my father helped invent was one of the patent holders for the convection oven.
Oh, Mike.
Which was completely, my father accidentally invented the convection oven by trying to force heat at the food. They turned the burners upside down and it circulated. Then that technology went out of favor, but now all of a sudden it's considered the, you know, epitome of baking technology. And I was watching that show, PBS, How We Got Here, which is really fascinating. I'm infinitely curious. And one of the things, because you mentioned cool technology, the idea of patents that a gentleman had invented air conditioning so many years before, but at the time, because they hadn't cataloged everything existing on Earth at that point, they didn't have the technology to really create what he envisioned, and somebody else took that patent. Everybody was racing to find that X factor, which I guess turned out to be Freon, and next thing you know, we got to air conditioning. And I wonder how that relates to things like green technology now, and you know, the idea of we want to go fast and stupid with our technology instead of slow and smart, and how does somebody break the reign of old companies wanting to hold and grab onto what they have, and like you mentioned, in companies where somebody has a product and they're like, we don't want it, but it could actually bring them the success that they're looking for. So it's a lot of stuff.
Yeah. I didn't look at the business side, so you can answer that question. And, you know, that is such a big political struggle, I think, that we all have to participate in. But what you said about patents evolving, you know, that somebody, they almost evolve in this Darwinian manner where you can look through the patent system and see, you know, the motor being attached to the bike becoming the motorcycle. And in part of my research, I went into this amazing, kooky, found this incredible guy named Jenrich Altshuler, who was this guy in Azerbaijan. But anyway, he had these, science fiction writer, but he had this whole these theories about the evolutions of ideas in the patent system and how you can actually see how the human mind works by studying the patent system and, you know, almost backwards engineering it to seeing how ideas, you know, how ideas evolve and meld together and come together like species and stuff, which is really cool. And I think you see that. And like you said, there's probably ideas about green tech that are hidden in there. And that's another thing. It's like trying to mine all the ideas. But then how you actually fight for them and, you know, commercialize them. And I don't know, you can that's the really challenging thing. I don't know if you have ideas about that.
I guess, a few. I think I'm not like often a Marxist, but the one thing that would make me, you know, really become a Marxist is this economic analysis of patents, because it's so often that the inventor is not actually the one who's getting monetarily rewarded. And so really this idea of privatized IP is just an invention of the 20th century that I think before we saw lots of ways in which companies were actually pooling knowledge, that R&D was much more shared across a sector. Certainly this was, you know, part of the Industrial Revolution in England that started with steel mills sharing best practices. And I think more and more you see companies experimenting with this. How can they actually share R&D costs across sectors so that if one company is spending 15 years, you know, investigating a target that could cure cancer and then finds out it doesn't work, it's in their interest to not tell their competitor. So their competitor could very well invest the same amount of resources in going after that target, which from a public interest standpoint is horrible. That's awful. And so how do we create incentives for them to actually be able to share some of that risk, share some of that cost and the opportunity? And so you're seeing people now experiment not just with open innovation, which is, you know, reaching out to through an incentive and platforms like this, but also through walled gardens. So creating these little cartels where people can create safe spaces for IP to be shared. And I think the other interesting component of your question was around this idea of like innovation graveyards or the sort of ghosts of great ideas that we so often don't have access to. I've worked with so many organizations where someone was working on an initiative very similar that was, you know, dead 20 years ago, but they did all the work around it. And that knowledge is just totally lost. And so I think the hope is that in moving to much more open innovation kinds of systems and looking at different models of patenting more towards Creative Commons and different kinds of licensing, that we'll actually be in a position where we'll have much more visibility, that it won't take on average, I think it's like 30 to 40 years for an innovation to actually be adopted from the point it's invented. So I think all of those are good signs, but it's still, I think there are interests at stake that really prevent that from
happening. And actually, just to add to that, like you're making me think of an example where I think the green tech space is really difficult, but I've been really interested in a similar problem in pharmaceuticals, which is it takes $5 billion to develop one drug, right? And like 17 years to get it to market. Well, you know, we're seeing, because of the disintermediation of research, essentially, you're seeing, I talked to one guy who's pioneering this new way that would essentially allow two grad students in a Starbucks to find a drug target, do all the research, do all the mouse studies and all of that, and actually get it into the clinic within 2 years. And that involves, you can on the internet, I love the internet, you can like hire, you know, people at a very reputable lab to do, like the way you'd hire an Uber to do a mouse study. So from your laptop, and you can also, there's petabytes of public data about genes that nobody's ever looked at. I won't get into why, but it's complicated, but that is available to all of us. If you can find drug targets in that, you can then take it to the mouse study and, you know, go on from there. And so I think, you know, we talk about big pharma. I think we're about to enter the era of small pharma, where the next pharma companies are going to be in garages. And in fact, that's already kind of starting, and where people are outsourcing like little bits, the parts they can't do in the garage. And so there's like those companies better, those big unwieldy companies better watch out, because
they don't do anything anymore. There, a lot of them that now they just do insourcing, which means all of their invention actually happens elsewhere, and they're just a platform. The things they do well are kind of like marketing and lobbying the government, and so like those will have a certain utility for these smaller players. But I think you're totally right. I think we'll see much more distributed kinds of production.
Yeah,
no, those are both great thoughts. I mean, I think, too, as you both touched on, there is a lot happening, especially with the digital space, with technology, with social media, with apps that are connecting people directly to each other. You're seeing more of that sharing. And so this idea of someone's ideas being lost, now you have the internet, now you have ways to connect directly to a distributor, someone who can actually build the product for you. And so I think it seems as if, you know, there's a big shift that's happening within when it comes to intellectual property and inventions. So we're just out of time. I want to thank both of our writers here, Pagan, Alexa. This was a great conversation. I hope you guys enjoyed talking about being creative and got some useful tips and insights from both of our writers here. Again, these are their books that have a lot more details and insights into the minds of great inventors, as well as other misfits who are creative as well. So thank you guys so much, and thank you.
Thank you,
guys. Yeah, thanks.